Paul Rucker says his artwork is kind of like aversion therapy, when you force yourself to confront the things that scare you.
I did this shot a few times, and I think this is the one that's going to be the one that I'm going to use.
Rucker has just come back here to his studio with some new material. He created it at a local shooting range. He spent the afternoon there working on a piece he's titling Excessive Force.
It really rips it open.
Now he's looking back through the work, flipping through sheets of high-grade art paper that are riddled with bullet holes. Each one of these sheets represents a person shot by the police.
I actually take sheets of paper and I shoot the number of bullet holes into the pieces of paper. Like for Oscar Grant, who was killed by the BART officer in Oakland, there's one bullet in the sheet. For Amadou Diallo, there's 41 bullets in the sheet. For Sean Bell, there's 50 bullets. You just go on and on. And the one that took the longest today was this couple in Cleveland that were chased by about 104 policemen, and they were shot at 137 times. So I split up two sheets of paper, and I think I shot in one sheet 74 times and the other sheet 60-something times. But it was pretty brutal when you're holding the gun and you're shooting into this paper and you realize how many actual bullets are going into someone's body. Or, you know, it doesn't take that much. I mean, to kill someone, it doesn't take that many bullets. And the other piece was that I did today was about this 66-year-old woman who was about 4 months behind on her rent. And the police came in, they busted in. They said she resisted, and they ended up shooting her with a 12-gauge shotgun. So I actually shot a 12-gauge today to show what two shots of a 12-gauge looks like. This is a 66-year-old woman who was 4 months behind on her rent, and she ended up getting shot once near the hand, and the next one went into her heart.
I think one of the things that, you know, ends up being so powerful about your work is the emotional distance and the sort of scientific quality of what you're doing when you take these numbers, these moments in history, and you create these artistically infused symbols. But really what you are doing is documenting history.
I think I'm a method artist. I actually want to be really part of the process and understand. There's this one piece called One Less Thing to Worry About, where I took commercially available target that resembled Trayvon Martin, and I took that and I reconfigured the target. It'll be displayed in the gallery, and inside a safe below the piece will be my Glock 22 semi-automatic pistol. I took it to the range today and three clips of ammunition, and I also got a concealed weapons permit, which was pretty easy to do, in Washington State, and all of that's in the safe, and it'll be in the gallery during the show. And I also wanted to explore the access to firearms, so I started making a 3D printed gun, the Liberator, which is available online for a while. But I always want to go through the process, even though I may not actually use the item in the way that a lot of people use it for. I still want to go through the process of seeing how it feels to do that. But I didn't really need a gun, but I wanted to understand people's fear of guns. It was really important for me to understand the adverse reaction people get when you tell them you have a gun. And people respond so differently in different situations.
Tell me more about this, Paul. This is fascinating. This, you can call it an artistic pursuit, a philosophical pursuit. This sort of entree into the world of gun ownership and gun ranges and shooting. I mean, do you feel like it's changed you? Do you feel like it's given you some sort of larger perspective, a better understanding of one or the other side of this issue?
This is so much of this show, you can talk about power. You can talk about the abuse of power, the use of power, the use of intimidation as a tool. And guns scare people, and people feel very confident when they have a gun. And there are 89 guns for every 100 people in the United States. We have a lot of guns. We are a gun culture. And we're talking about 89 guns for every 100 people. If you do plus or minus, you know, 10%, we really have about, you know, 1-to-1 gun ratio for everyone in the United States. And why do we have so many guns? And I try to figure out the why of something.
So, Paul, when you go to the gun range and you've got your pieces of paper that you're going to use for this project, you start shooting. I mean, are people curious about what you're up to, or they just think you're out there for target practice like everyone else?
No, they're definitely curious. I mean, I get odd looks when I go to the gun range, and because I don't really shoot like I shoot not to be accurate. I shoot because I'm drawing. It's a way of I'm making art. You know, I'm imagining myself in a situation of shooting someone who's innocent, which is a odd place to be. And the most difficult thing I'm realizing is to have empathy for everyone, and putting myself in a position of a policeman is scary. It's scary because your life is on the line. You don't know what someone's going to do. And I think with the recent shootings in New York, I think it's even scarier. And I mean, with the number of guns, that we actually do pretty well. But the gun range experience is really different because I go there with archival paper, 300 GSM, you know, acid-free paper. And most of the targets are for throwaway. I mean, they're cheap newsprint paper. And so I'm putting heavier paper on the target holders, which sometimes they actually fall off before they make it back to me, which is not a good thing.
But, yeah, because I guess if your piece of paper comes off the paper clip out there, you're not going out there to grab it with...
No, you leave it. I actually shot a shotgun today for this piece for the 66-year-old woman, and I didn't know how to use the shotgun. I mean, it's actually pretty amazing how easy it is to get a gun that you don't know how to use and rent it for, you know, actually you rent it just for a $10 gun fee, and I had a shotgun. I haven't shot a shotgun since I was 12, but this thing was pretty amazing and pretty scary, and I cocked it when I didn't need to cock it, and a shell went, you know, a full shell went flying into the area, the gun range area, and I was not going to pick it up. And gun ranges are quite dangerous. I mean, you're in a row of people, you're all next to each other, and all it takes is someone who just doesn't know what they're doing to actually fire the gun in a way that they shouldn't fire it. There was an incident recently where I think it was a 3-year-old or 5-year-old that shot their parents. I can't remember if it was 3 or 5. There have been 3 lately incidents like that. There's the one woman that was shot in Walmart by her 3 or 5-year-old. There's one 3-year-old that shot a 5-year-old sister or brother. And then the newest one was the kid that shot dad. The bullet went into dad and then out of dad and into mom. I mean, that's pretty amazing. People think that bullets stop, but bullets can keep going and they can ricochet. And so I have a respect for guns, you know, the same kind of big respect I have for horses. Horses are beautiful and big, but they could stomp you if they wanted to. And you got to respect the power of these things.
Tell me how you felt when you left the gun range today after firing that many shots into that many targets that all represented, you know, bullets coming from police into black citizens.
I have a double answer for that. It's disturbing because I shot about 200 rounds today. And that's a lot of rounds. And ammunition is not cheap. Is, I think, 25 rounds. Actually, I think 50 rounds is about $25. So it can add up. But since I was doing this work for the show, I was glad to have one more piece done for the show. So that part, there was a relief. But then I'm glad when it's done. You know, I feel less intimidated by the gun. I feel I have more experience with the gun. And it doesn't scare me the way it used to scare me. When I got my concealed weapons permit in Washington State, it was one of the easiest things that I ever had to do. I went in, got fingerprinted, paid a small fee, and actually the FBI fee for fingerprinting actually dropped in price. I mean, they're actually making guns more accessible by dropping that fee. And it was easy. 4 weeks later, I got a concealed weapons permit in the mail. And later I went to buy my first gun. I got a Glock 22 40 caliber pistol because that was a standard police issue gun for a while. I'm not sure what they're using now, but I went to pick up this gun and I went to a gun shop, and it was odd because I was looking at musical equipment first and the guy was fine. I was looking at microphones because I'm a recording engineer. Then I started looking at the guns, and as he was showing me the guns, I noticed his hands were shaking a little bit. He wasn't comfortable showing me the guns. And I get the same vibe at the gun range sometime when I go to the gun range. I think some of the other folks there don't really want to see me with a gun. I think when a lot of times when people talk about, you know, we want to keep our guns. They're talking about our guns, not you having our guns.
This gun range is all full of white folks except for you when you walk in there.
For the most part, yes. Actually, there was one Asian guy, and another black guy came in later. And so, but mostly it's white and older white guys. But then there was a young couple that came in, young white couple that came in. So it really is also a luxury, too, to be able to go and fire bullets. And when each bullet costs, you know, 25 to 50 cents or more, depending on what kind of bullets you're using, that's an expensive hobby to have, plus targets.
One sort of logical corollary of this project of yours is that when people come and see these targets that have one bullet hole or six bullet holes or 41 bullet holes or 170 bullet holes, mm-hmm. that they'll realize, oh, these were all fired by a black American. Mm-hmm. That's got its own sort of political implications then too.
Yeah, there's a lot of art that I'm making that people may give me a pass because I'm black making it, and I don't think that's fair. There can definitely be reverse racism, reverse sexism, and if I create work about women's rights, I may get positive support, and I may get some angry women saying, what gives you the right? I'm thinking, but everyone's fight is everyone's fight. If I want to fight for Jewish relations, that's why I have this piece about Leo Frank, you know, actually the one of the most documented lynchings in the history of America, I should, as a black person, have a right to advocate for Jewish folks without, you know, fearing any kind of hostility towards me. And if you look at the early NAACP, if it wasn't for other people, white people and other people fighting, we wouldn't be where we are today. And we need that movement today. And I think what's happening now with the protests is that we have a wide variety of people, wide range of people, social demographic, you know, young, old. And it's really an amazing thing to have that representation of people that are actually concerned. But it's really an odd thing to when you start advocating and start talking about things, you know, because you want to feel free to be an advocate for other people that don't necessarily look like you.
You know, I think that the amount of sort of history and science that goes into your work makes you, in a sense, a little bit more of that abstract sort of every person observer that can represent anybody who's at the exhibition as well.
Yeah, my mom told me when I was younger that I didn't really play on the playground. Like toddler size, I would just look around. And I've always loved people watching. I've always loved observing people and how they move and how they interact with each other. And I really noticed when people are being discriminated against or being treated differently because they're a woman or because they may be overweight. I mean, it's rampant in how people are being treated. And I'll never forget, I was in a Walmart line a few years ago, and this young black kid, probably 11 or 12, who was really happy he was buying a toy, and he gave the woman at the counter, you know, $20. And then the woman just looked at the $20 and tried to see if it was real or not. It was a young little black kid, and she took a long time to see if this $20 bill was real. I'm thinking, but the kid didn't really notice what she was doing, but I noticed what she was doing. Or even if you, like, leave one of those big box stores where they check your receipt on the way out. I've had my receipt checked for longer periods of time. You notice these small little things. But I've also realized that the people that are doing this don't always realize that they're doing it or even why they're doing it. So I've observed a lot of human interaction. And a lot of my work is based on how can we all get in the same room together and talk about this without making anyone get defensive. And it's very, very difficult. I think when I was growing up in the South, we used to say, don't talk about three things, religion, politics, and abortion. And that was it. They didn't say race. And race is probably one of the biggest elephants in the room right now. I think race is the biggest elephant in the room, actually. And the only reason it's so big is because we haven't really had a real conversation about race in America. And we're kind of at a tipping point where we really have to talk about it. We have to talk about the legacy of race and the history. And what this show is going to do is going to give a lot of history that's not talked about, the history that you didn't learn in school, kind of like the uncomfortable history that we didn't talk about growing up.
Paul Rucker's solo exhibition Rewind opens this Saturday, February 7th, at the Creative Alliance on Eastern Avenue. His piece, Excessive Force, which he talked about in this radio story, is just one of many, many multidisciplinary works that are going to be on display on two floors, 3,000 square feet, representing the past 6 years of his career. Work that includes sculpture, musical composition, film, video, animations, and data visualizations. This is a huge exhibition and a thought-provoking one. Rucker plans to be on hand regularly during the run to talk with groups about the work in dialogue sessions and other special events. All the details about Paul Rucker's Rewind are online at creativealliance.org. For The Signal, I'm Aaron Hinkin.